this piece of conductor will start to resonate. So you may think about a piece of copper lying on the table of the length of 10 centimeters, and that is also, even if it's not connected, the resonating piece of conductor. That's why we have antenna. And to XGN. Dr. Roy.
I think the point is not to have a demonstrable eddy current occurring on the core. At the most, you're having these pro eddy currents that are bound within the grain. And all I can imagine is it's not helpful because it's going to produce some amount of heat loss, which is going to radiate and can lead to heat damage. But again, I'm not quite sure if there's true resonance going on. It's just a very small degree of eddy current in these microscopic, you know, micron-sized grains of iron and other metals that have a nanometer thick oxide layer covering them. So I don't know exactly if you can call that an impedance and a harmonic. It's other things, at least in my mind.
Ferro resonance or nonlinear resonance is the type of resonance in electric circuits which occurs when circuits containing nonlinear inductance is fed from the source that has a series of capacitance, and the circuit is subjected to the disturbance, such as opening of the switch. That is what I'm reading about ferro resonance. Now, we may create ferro resonance by induction, and we may create ferro resonance by delivering the frequency at which the physical length of the particle would make it resonate in with interferite. Do you agree with that, Dr. Roy?
Well, yeah, I mean, I kind of see you're kind of reading from Wikipedia's entry on ferro resonance, which I'm really talking about a ferromagnetic thing. And, I don't exactly know, it was sort of talking about the same thing, because we're not really talking about an electrical current, per se. We're talking about a method of basically conducting magnetic lines of flux. In a perfect world, that would be the only thing that you would use the soft ferrite for. When you start to carry current, that's where the trouble comes, and that's where the heat, patient, and the damage comes. So I think it's best to think of it in a perfect world of soft ferrites, where it's simply conducting magnetic lines of force rather than trying to figure out where the eddy currents and other currents are coming and going to.
Thank you for that explanation. If you could say a few words about nuclear magnetism and magnetic moment and friction.
VDH with a question.
VDH, please give me your question.
Yeah, fine business. Question is about ferrites and their use in an isolator or circulator. Doesn't the permeability of the ferrite have to be described by a tensor that is a magnetic excitation in one direction can cause a response in another direction, so that it's not necessarily related to the direction that you're exciting it in? And isn't that the effect that's used in ferrite isolators? Go ahead.
I think I will turn to my colleague, an electrical engineer, because he's had a great deal more experience with isolators than I ever had. So, Dick, can you answer that one?
Yeah, at the company I worked at called Airborne Instruments Laboratory, there was a guy who was a real pro on isolators. But the magnetic material, the puck, it looks like a hockey puck that's in the middle of one particular kind of design of circulator isolator, has a biasing magnetic field going through it, and the net result is that your velocity of propagation of a radio signal through the material has two different velocities depending on whether you're going clockwise or counterclockwise around this circulating puck, and the magnetic field is at right angles to it. So you end up with signals being in phase between port number one and port number two, but out of phase between port number one and port number three because of this difference in velocity of propagation of the radio signal through the ferrite material because of the biasing magnetic field, the steady state magnet alongside of it. What's interesting about the circulators you can buy is that every circulator has a frequency where it gives you the best performance. You can make that best performance go up or down in frequency beyond the original design if you add or subtract from the steady state magnet that's there. So there are guys who have bought a circulator that was made for 10 gigahertz and used it on 12 gigahertz and vice versa by using that phenomenon. I don't really have, and by the way, this difference in velocity of propagation is called gyrotropy. So gyrotropic materials, ferrite-like materials with a biasing magnetic field, give you these magic properties that allow you to build isolators. And
repeater, timeout.
Isolators and circulators are very handy. In theory, you could use a circulator and an isolator, a circulator, such that the common port, so to speak, is the antenna, and one port is the transmitter and one port is the receiver. In theory, you can make sure that all the signal coming down the antenna goes into the receiver, all the signal from the transmitter goes up to the antenna and doesn't go into the receiver. So, now, can you get enough isolation by that means? An extremely well-tuned circulator can give you numbers like 30 and 40 decibels, and I've even seen one as high as 50 decibels of directivity. But to really have a duplexing filter at a repeater, you'd like to have 110 dB of directivity. And that, by way of circulators, is probably unachievable. Oh, you, Roy. I'm giving you little snippets of information that I've picked up over the years. I'm far from an expert on this one. AC2GS, K2LIW.
Okay, thank you very much, Dick. VDH, did that supply enough of an answer?
Well, I guess what I was wondering is what is actually happening as far as the, I guess, the electron shell, or what's happening at the atomic level that's affecting the magnetic field. Does the static magnetic field, how does that affect the electron structure actually in the ferrite material? Okay.
Part of the gyrotropy really is precession. Whenever you watch a child's top settle down, it moves in a characteristic way which is called precession. It turns out that at the molecular level, that kind of action is taking place inside of the gyrotropic material. And as you change the strength of the steady-state magnetic field, the rate at which precession is taking place changes. And I presume that when the signal is propagating in the direction of the precession, you get one velocity of propagation, and when the signal is propagating in the other direction, you get another velocity of propagation. I think, but I'm not sure, that's a little bit about what's going on at the molecular level. N2HUH, over to you, Joe, I think it is. No. HUH, Lou. Over to you, Lou. K2LIW. As you can tell, I don't really know.
This is WA2VDH. Yeah, okay, fine. That explains it a bit. Thanks, Dick. Appreciate it.
Sorry, I confused you, John. Over to you, Roy.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Dick, and thank you, John. I wanted to mention a couple of things that Wesley wanted me to mention, just to do it rather lightly, because, again, this is another subject that people could write a book and probably have many on the subject. Any charged object traveling at any constant velocity produces a stable magnetic field. With protons and neutrons, they also have a quantum mechanical concept called the spin, which is not really the same thing as when you're playing with a top and spinning it, but it works very similar. So it has angular qualities, and it's charged, and so electrons and protons produce magnetic dipole moments. If they're paired with another one that's rotating in the opposite direction, allows and there's no net magnetic moment. So in unpaired electrons or unpaired neutrons, you have magnetic moments. Most of the ferromagnetism and other magnetism that we see all the time is due to the magnetic field produced by the half-filled shell of electrons. But nuclear magnetic resonance imaging uses another technique that depends upon the magnetic dipole moment of protons in atoms. They produce a magnetic field that causes those protons to line up, and then they insert radio frequency signals, and they read when there's a dip. When there's a dip, what's happening is the atoms are actually absorbing the energy and using it to change the rotational direction of the... So that, in a very short way, is what nuclear magnetism and magnetic dipole moments are for you, Wesley. You okay with that?
Yes, I am. Actually, I could add something to it. Paired electrons always have opposite speed. So there is their magnetic moments cancel each other or give a null magnetic moment. But the presence of unpaired electrons in the atom lends to magnetic property and creates this magnetic moment that maybe creates not the proper way. The magnetic moment remains uncancelled. They agree with that. Oh, before that, iron atom has an atomic number 26, and there are four unpaired electrons, and the third subshell is the one that has them, which gives the right to magnetic in the iron atom. Atosian.
Yes, Wes, I agree with you. It's just restating what I said before, that there's something called the Pauli exclusion principle, which is that things like electrons, you can't have two electrons with the same quantum numbers being in the same place. So that requires that if you have two electrons in a filled shell, one has to be a spin in one direction, the other one has to have a spin in the other. If they had both the spin in the same direction, you would violate the Pauli exclusion rule. So it's the unpaired electrons that have a net magnetic dipole moment, and the more they have, the more they have the magnetic dipole moment. But again, like all things, there are complications. There are reasons why things are paramagnetic versus why some other things are ferromagnetic, why some materials can align themselves temporarily but can't get stuck and stabilized into that locked position. And again, that's probably a good thing for a graduate level course in magnetism.
Well, talking about paramagnetism and diamagnetism, interesting angular momentum, we call it spin in electrons, usually in the D orbit. Ferromagnetism is the strongest by far, and that is related to the crystal structures. It allows formation of domains. Do you agree with that?
You're sort of going back into history, because you're talking about crystal field theory, which was an interesting basis for the way that electrons lined up and operated, and they got it rather close. It was kind of made semi-pointless with Schrodinger's equation, where you can plug in the numbers and you can get the exact orbital probability cloud. So I agree with you that the force of ferromagnetism is greater than the force of most paramagnetic and diamagnetic materials, although I'm sure you could find, especially near the Curie point, where that falls apart. It has to do with a bunch of things, and you really have to be very light with the angular momentum, because it's not really angular momentum. If electrons had true angular momentum in the non-existent dimension that it exists, it's zero microns wide, such, it would violate all kinds of laws of physics. So it's not angular momentum. It's more that it's the angular momentum of the wave function of the electron, which is a kind of esoteric way of saying things, but it helps not to break the laws of physics that way.
I must agree with you. This is unfortunate wording that I'm using. Because the nuclear magnetism is determined by the flow of charge and distribution, the interesting spins with the nucleus measurement of the magnetic dipole moments gives those important insight into the internal structure of the nucleus. And from that perspective, we could look at the processes that are taking place. And to explain.
I would tend to not want to use the term flow and pretty much just rather make it even vaguer, which is movement, because flow kind of denotes some current, some directionality, whereas in the case of electrons and protons, they're really most of the time not going anywhere. Their angular momentum of their wave function is the thing that's rotating in space-time. So I would say move rather than flow, but it's just a semantic thing.
Well, it depends what we look at. That's why I was pondering on. That's why I was pondering when I was talking about magnetic domains. I was pondering the certain properties of the magnetic domains, which would actually create a flow. But that would be not in flow in means of magnetic flow, which I totally agree with your movement, but the flow of the charges. And to XGM.
Again, I tend to think we're getting muddy by semantics. You have to sort of, it's not even accurate to say that you're looking at electrons. They're not going from point A to point B. They're not really even just spinning like a top. It's more esoteric. So for all intents and purposes, the electron, if you could actually see it, wouldn't look like it's doing much of anything. So to call that flowing, I wouldn't use that term.
Yeah, we're getting deeper and deeper. So what is happening when you have a piece of the conductor, whatever the length is, that could be related later on to the length of the magnetic domain, the physical diameter, and its frequency of resonance. What is happening in piece of the conductor that is lying on the table, or what is happening with the piece of the conductor that is inside of the Yagi antenna? And to achieve.
Okay, I think at this point you're actually talking about inductance, which isn't exactly the same thing as just magnetism per se. I mean, inductance does induce magnetic fields, but they're not quite the same thing, and they can be induced by conducting materials that have no ferro or even paramagnetism. You could use diamagnetic conductors to make an electromagnet, and it would work PCT as long as you kept the current going.
We are on the right direction. We have inductance and when you have a capacitance. Those two create a resonant frequency at which, at that given length of the conductor, we have a resonance. What is happening when we have a resonance in the piece of the conductor? And to exist.
Well, again, we're kind of flying very far away from the subject matter at hand, because I don't think, there's some infinitesimal inductance in a piece of wire. There's also probably some really infinitesimal capacitance surrounding the wire, so that's why people who work on microwaves have such a hard time, that inductors tend to have capacitance, and capacitors tend to have inductances, and they all have resonance frequencies, and it can get very confusing and very complicated. But I don't know if it really serves well to go into those strange little environments when we're just talking about something that's complicated enough, like the spin, the angular momentum spin of electrons producing magnetic dipole moments. I think that's about as far as I feel like going tonight without confusing the heck out of everyone, including myself.
So the last thing, Jeff, we have a piece of metal, which is iron, and then we have a changing magnetic field, which actually changes the direction of the domain. And that goes into the resonance. We have a property of inductance, we have a property of capacitance, and we have a changing magnetic field. And then we have a magnetism that is actually being influenced by the electrical properties of the domain. What do you think about that?
I think we're missing something. Most of these qualities are static for the most part. You have to apply energy to get oscillations and changes. Things left to themselves, I mean, that's why ferromagnets just sit there and be ferromagnets. They don't kind of reverse their polarities for no apparent reason. You acquire hysteresis loss to kind of shove them in the other direction. So I think you're leaving out some kind of energy source that would be needed to do with some of this stuff.
Without energy that is delivered to the ferrite, there is no action of the ferrite. Ferrite is dead, doesn't react. Any transformer that you have, you're actually changing the direction of the domain. All I was talking about is just that change, rate of change, is resonance of the physical length of the particle. What's happening? What's happening in molecular level, and what's happening in that ferrite particle of the physical ferrite?
Okay, so it seems that we've kind of gone around and we've ended up at the beginning once again, where you want to discuss the resonance of soft ferrite. And my gut feeling, since I haven't read anything of any value on the subject that addresses that sort of thing, is that the nature of soft ferrite, other factors become incredibly more important before you ever get to the point where the eddy currents produce, do any kind of resonance screwing around with its results. So I think it's one of those things. It's sort of like trying to find the melting point of a tree. Long before you can come to a temperature where the cellulose will liquefy, it reacts and the bonds get broken and it gets turned into something else. So, again, haven't read anything about soft ferrite. The resonance that you were talking about is ferro-resonance, not ferro-resonance. So I'm not quite sure whether this applies to soft ferrite. So I'm at a loss as far as that goes.
Resonance creates overvoltages and overcurrents in the electrical power system and pose the risk to transmission distribution equipment and to operational personnel and to HGS.
Roy, I think we really should move on. We're going to be putting our audience to sleep. We've gone a little bit too deep on this one. If two or three people want to really dig into it, then they should have a private conversation, but I don't think we should hang up the whole group that signs into this net by dwelling on this one subject at this level for a very long period of time. I'm afraid of putting them to sleep. Over to you, Roy. KQRIW.
No, I agree with you entirely, Dick. Wesley, if you don't mind, I think we've gone down this rabbit hole as deep as we can tonight. Well, I'll do some more reading and we'll see what happens. Let me move on to the next story.
Thank you very much for giving me time for that.
Let's see. Well, one bit of science that's been played up in recent news relates to the polygraph, lie detection. We shall steer clear of any caustic politics and take a look at polygraphs and only polygraphs. The polygraph historian Ken Adler wrote, has long been treated as America's mechanical conscience. People turn to the machine in times of crisis, demanding clarity from biomedical readouts, hoping something as simple as a heart rate can distinguish what's true from what's false. Individuals with evidence on their side still feel compelled to take these steps to appease the larger public, and those with the evidence stacked against them hold up polygraph results as if they trump the obvious truth. Yet, for almost as long as there have been polygraph tests, there has been evidence that the machines don't really work. It's a lie detector, neither man nor machine. The first empirical review of the machinery concluded in 1965, a view that has been supported by every scientific publication on the topic since. Except in very rare circumstances, the results of a polygraph are not admitted to court in the United States, and the test's overall usefulness has been publicly revealed time and time again. The Green River Killer, Gary Ridgway, passed the lie detector test in 1987, delaying justice for almost two decades. Let me drop for a second. So, why do we keep strapping in? It seems our endless search for the truth makes us vulnerable to a few pernicious lies. Since its inception almost 100 years ago, the polygraph has remained largely unchanged. Really, three tests in one, the polygraph concurrently monitors cardiovascular, respiratory, and electrodermal output of the human body. A blood pressure cuff monitors the blood flow in and out of your heart. A second apparatus measures the pulse. Rubber tubes placed on the chest track air entering and exiting your lungs. Finger plates track your sweat seeping through your skin. These biometric results are accurate, says John Sinnott, a lecturer in investigative forensic psychology at the University of Huddersfield. But it's the interpretation, the leap from physical data to psychological motive that so often fails. When people say the polygraph doesn't work, I call them on that, Sinnott said. The polygraph always works because all the polygraph does is measure physiological output. But he says it never detects a lie. Let me drop for a second. Writing in a 2015 paper in Crime Psychology Review, Sinnott summed up the uncomfortable truth at the center of the polygraph. When individuals actively attempt to detect deception, their accuracy levels are barely above chance. Psychologist William Marston, who also is known for creating Wonder Woman, invented the systolic blood pressure test and, in an article published in the early 1920s, claimed he could deduce the emotional states of some of his research subjects based on changes in this reading. Across the country, John Larson, a Berkeley, California police officer and trained physiologist, decided to build a machine incorporating the blood pressure test and several other metrics to use in investigations. One hope, Boulder notes, was to reduce police brutality by providing an impartial, non-invasive judge of character. Let me drop for a second. Many law enforcement officials were enthusiastic about the test, but the 1923 Supreme Court case of Frye versus the United States put the brakes on the polygraph's applicability in court. It ruled that the device could only be used if one day it gained wide approval from the scientific community, which never really happened. Today, police and national security agents still employ the test as ways to rule out or identify suspects. But according to Alder, most of the machine's success can be described as a sort of psychological placebo effect. Good lie detector operators are very skilled interrogators, he said. It isn't that the device itself is a good technology, that's sort of misdirected. The ability to definitively distinguish truth from lies will always hold an allure. We believe in the lie detector test, Alder concluded in his book, because we long for a form of justice that is swift and non-coercive, and because we expect that science can and will pierce the veil of earthly appearances. But after 100 years of mixed results, it's time to acknowledge the human conscience will never be perfected nor mechanized. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, no question. On to the next. Now, This story isn't as much a scientific discovery or a newly discovered mystery that science is looking for. This is more about how art and technology sometimes intertwines for very dubious purposes. There's this artist, Banksy. He's become famous for his iconoclastic, somewhat subversive art. It all kind of got born in the age of the graffiti art movement of the past few decades. Now, this guy Banksy has, surprisingly, in these very self-promoting narcissistic times, remained an anonymous figure. His art is usually displayed for the public to see and experience. He's never been one to promote the sale of his art, but nevertheless, the art world has embraced him, and his works of art have increased in value over time. Never was this more in evidence than at a recent auction at the elite Sotheby's, where a copy of Banksy's Girl with a Red Balloon was auctioned off for about $1.4 million. Let me drop for a second. With the average artist these days, the news is about the price that some art lover was willing to part with for a chance to own true art, but that isn't the case for good old Banksy. You see, as the auctioneer brought down his final gavel blow, someone in the crowd seems to have remotely actuated a mechanism hidden within the frame of this artwork. You guessed it, a paper shredder. Yep, about a third of the newly purchased artwork was shredded into thin strips below the bottom of the artwork's large wooden frame. And the funny thing is that Banksy's practical joke probably increased the value of this particular piece of art to these wealthy art fans. So perhaps other artists might consider shredding their art to increase its value. Take a try. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GF.
A VDH with a comment.
Yes, VDH.
I read that story, and my question about that is the person who triggered the shredder, did they ever catch him? Did they ever find any information about him? Good.
There remains a great deal of questions all over the place. There are some people who believe that Sotheby's was in on the gag. There are some that don't. Most people don't believe the cover story. The cover story was that this was an owned artwork dating back to 2006. But most people feel that the mechanism wouldn't just sit there for 12 years and work flawlessly. So the probable guess is that Banksy himself set this gag up in reasonably recent time. But they're not 100% sure. They have photographs. They have a lot of people with cell phone photographs all over the place. They sort of think that they see the guy who did it, but he was wearing a disguise. He was wearing a hat. He was wearing shades. So lots of luck trying to find out who he is. So I don't know exactly how much of a trick this was by Banksy, but he succeeded, and the person who bought the artwork doesn't want a refund. I think it's a woman. She wants to hold on to it. She thinks it's increased in value because of the practical joke.
I think in the future they're going to have to put some kind of maybe radio frequency jamming equipment in there to bring it back to an RF topic, some kind of RF jamming to prevent a remote control kind of thing.
Maybe just a trick.
Well, it sort of goes back to this, the previous month or two ago about the microwave versus sound waves, but you could trigger a device using ultrasonics as well. So I think the giveaway is it was in a really big, heavy frame that seems kind of oversized for the purpose. So again, I don't know. I tend to think that there was someone in Sotheby's sort of knew what was going on. Because otherwise, they just unscrew the back of the frame and say, why are there razor blades in this? Any further statements, VDA?
I think in the future, they better x-ray the frames to make sure they're not vulnerable for things like this. Go ahead, VDH.
That's my only comment. Thanks.
Yeah, I would agree with you, Dick, that if it's not a scam on Sotheby's part, that they should kind of, especially with these group of artists, start to x-ray the frames, because it's not going to damage anything. But again, I'm a little suspicious. I think they like the publicity myself. Okay, on with the next. Let's see. This winter's flu season was quickly recognized as one of the worst to come along in a long time. But new data from the Center of Disease Control and Prevention highlights just how destructive it was in the United States. According to new data, there were 80,000 flu-related deaths last season, the single highest toll seen in at least four decades. Across the board, the 2017 to 2018 flu season was brutal. There were an estimated 900,000 people hospitalized for the flu, resulting in the highest hospitalization rate seen in modern history, breaking previous records established during the 2014 to 2015 season. And the number of reported pediatric deaths, 180, was the highest ever caused by a seasonal flu since the current surveillance system was established in 2004, although the 2009 swine flu pandemic, which is not considered a seasonal flu, killed more children. Let me drop for a sec. Now, because our system of tracking flu-related death and illness has changed over the years, it's become difficult to know the last time that the seasonal flu was quite as deadly. But we do know that 80,000 deaths dwarf any annual number reported as far back as the 1976 to 1977 season. The previous record holder was the 2012-2013 season, which saw 56,000 deaths. Pandemic flu strains have been deadlier, though. However, particularly the 1918 Spanish flu, which killed an estimated 650,000 Americans. Part of the reason why this past season was so horrible has to do with the most predominant strain that was circulating in the country, an influenza A virus called H3N2. H3N2 is known to be more virulent than other seasonal strains, and to make matters worse, vaccines against H3N2 tend to be less effective. According to the CDC data, the vaccine this time around was only 25% effective against H3N2. Let me drop for a second. Still, the vaccine certainly saved lives. Overall, it was about 40% effective at preventing flu from all three major strains in this past season. And its effectiveness was even better in age groups known to have a higher risk of complications, such as the very young. Despite the added media attention, the average percentage of Americans who got vaccinated barely budged from previous seasons, the CDC reported. The CDC reports that the majority, that's 80% of children who died from the flu last winter, were unvaccinated. And even during the 2012-2013 season, another season when vaccines weren't very effective against H3N2, the vaccines still prevented more than 10,000 deaths, according to the CDC. The CDC plans to release its estimates of how much death and illness the vaccine prevented during the 2017-2018 season later this year. But the take-home message has always been clear. Get the damn flu shot. The CDC recommends getting it before the end of October this year. So even a later shot can still help. You might just save a life. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2. Yeah.
Roy, have you heard that senior citizens are getting either a bigger dose or a more potent dose? Isn't there something different being given to senior citizens, K2RIW?
Yes, you are completely right. We sort of had a similar conversation probably about a year ago on this. And there is a stronger dose that tends to be recommended for immunocompromised and elderly people that have a higher dose of the material. It causes some slight increase in possible mild side effects, but it is a thing to consider when you're choosing what kind of vaccine you're giving a person.
Do they keep records, Roy, on the percentage of people who get the vaccine, get the flu shot, and become mildly sick because of it? Does that happen to, say, 5 or 10% of those who get the shot? And do the senior citizens get more of the side effects?
Yeah, they tend to make studies of these things. You can't be completely accurate because sometimes people don't return to the doctor to complain about anything. But they give approximations, and as you mentioned, it's usually something in the 5 to 10%. It's probably a little bit higher in people who take the stronger booster shot. But unfortunately, we're not in the time of the late 70s, early 80s, when there was the Guillain-Barré scare, where vaccinations, and we still don't quite know what the heck caused them, gave people Guillain-Barré syndrome.
Next up.
I think I stepped on someone's call sign. Does someone want to make a statement or a comment?
GSW. Is there an alternative way to deliver the flu vaccine without a shot?
Well, there is mucosal method. It's not as definitive as a subcutaneous shot. You know exactly the dose, and it's going to stay inside, and it's going to be, whereas if you squirt it up your nose, some of it might be absorbed in the mucous membrane, or if you have a particularly runny nose, not so much. So I don't know. I'm sure they're working on all kinds of fun stuff. They're probably working on some kind of transdermal patch. But so far the tried and true method seems to be a subcutaneous injection.
Whiskey 2, Bravo Zulu.
Yes, Rich.
Maybe I missed this, but are there any statistics of people who got the flu shot, who got the flu?
Yes, unfortunately, it was in the story. One of the major viruses that had an effect is a variation of influenza A called H3N2. And the vaccination didn't really cover people that well. About 40% were reasonably well covered, 25% didn't have any kind of help from the vaccine. So, yeah, vaccines are not 100% effective. You have to guess a lot of things. There's a lot of different versions of the flu out there this time of the year, and they had to make their prediction something like 6 months ago of what would be important now. So you're kind of guessing a little bit around the edges.
Question.
Someone said question.
Roger. This is KC2, Queen, Yankee, Whiskey. My question is, what's the ingredients in the flu shot? Like, what is it made of? Back to you.
There's preservatives in it, which was scaring people because in the old days they had mercury-based stabilizers, and there was rumors that it caused autism in children, which it didn't. But there are stabilizers and such. But primarily, it's the proteins of denatured and dead influenza virus strains that are used for vaccination. As is the case in most vaccinations, tend to be either genetically mutated diminished activity live cells or fully powerful but dead cells. What our immune system requires are the protein layers on the surface of these things. Our immune system needs to kind of get to know it so that they can build defenses before they get assaulted with a major infection.
B2OIS.
Yes, Mark.
I'm glad you recognize my name. Anyway, so I don't take the flu shot. I think it's kind of dangerous. I think it's kind of crazy because already you've admitted that people do get sick from it, and the state of New York tells you that you can't get sick from it. You don't get the influenza from it. But I do. This time of the year, the best thing to do, like they do in Mexico City, is take vitamin D3. And you would take about 2,000 units and just keep taking it, and that should keep the flu away from you for free. And I'm not making any money off you. By the way, let me let it drop. Good response.
Well, Mark, I don't know exactly how to answer you. It wasn't a question really for me. Number one, they're saying that you don't get influenza because it's a dead influenza. You can get a reaction. It is not an infection of influenza, but it is a reaction. That's number one. Number two, being made a little sick is probably preferable to getting very sick, especially to getting very dead. So the people who died last year who probably would not go along with you if they had a second chance. But you are free in this country to do anything that you want. The problem with people who push other people to not be vaccinated is society has developed a herd immunities based on the number of people who get vaccinated. So if somehow there's enough people who don't bother to get vaccinated, it doesn't only put them at risk, but it puts the general population at risk. So if you go to places in Europe, they've had a spike of measles infections because of that very reason. So there are people dying now who've never died before. But, you know, God bless America, you're free to do whatever you want to do. You know, I mean, I tend to take the advice of physicians and researchers who have spent and dedicated their entire life to the field of medicine. If you want to get it off of, I don't know where you got it off of, then, you know, it's a free country. You can do what you want.
Apparently in New York State, it's mandatory in some places of work and in the school. I never understood how someone that is not sick can spread sickness among those take the shot. I could never understand this.
Mark, have you ever heard of typhoid, Mary?
And I've also heard of spreading polio in India because of the vaccine.
Look, everything, unfortunately, is able to be screwed up. You have to figure out the pluses versus the minuses. There are millions of people who are not either dead or in iron lungs because of the polio vaccine. Probably you would prefer to be in iron lungs and dead. I don't know. It's not a government thing. Not a conspiracy. I'm not being paid off by anyone anywhere. It's good science, and it shows up every time that they look and see how many people passed away and how many of them didn't bother to get vaccinated. So once again, you want to take the risk for yourself. It's not good for society because of problems with herd immunity, but it's a free country, so do what you want. In a lot of health environments and school environments, they are looking at the numbers and realizing that this is dangerous for children and for sick people in hospitals and such, and they're forcing people to not kill other people. So I'm kind of along with that. I'm not against that personally. But again, free country, you can do what you want.
Is there any difference between this year's vaccine and last year's?
Yes, Rich, they're always different because they're always mutating and they're changing. You know, unfortunately, it's a moving target. So if they kind of went back to the lab and said, aha, this is the exact H3N2 strain that we had that problem with, let's fine-tune it and bring it out, and then find out that the major influenza for this year is influenza B, oh well. So unfortunately, it's a moving target. Viruses are brilliant little things. They're not that terribly complicated, but they're complicated enough to be great at doing what they do, and they've been doing it for hundreds of millions of years, not particularly to us, but to other creatures.
Also read where last year it moved from east to west the fastest it ever did. Is that true?
I believe so, but, you know, there's so many complicating factors of where the of how things spread that you can't kind of depend upon that. I mean, it could very possibly go in the opposite direction this year. It just, epidemiology is more complicated than weather prediction.
Oh, so it's not.
Broke up with some noise. Is it definitively one-way directed? I don't think so. I mean, I haven't looked at all the reports and all the directions, but I'd be willing to guess that there are kind of strange directions. I don't think there's an inherent directionality to it. I don't know if that was you, Rich. I just got a blast of noise.
Roy, if the senior citizens get a more potent shot, what's their definition in this case for senior citizen? If I was joining the AARP, I think I'm considered a senior citizen at 50. I get a discount at my barber shop if I'm a senior citizen, and to them it's over 55. And when it comes to Social Security, I think you're a senior citizen at 65. So, what's the threshold of senior citizen for reference to the flu shot? Would you, Roy? KQRIW.
Net time complete.
Well, I mean, fortunately, doctors have wiggle room to decide on variations. You know, if a 50-odd-year-old guy is not in great shape, I would suggest it of him. Certainly anyone immunocompromised with any kind of chronic health issues. Probably around 60 is the cutoff point where they start to think about it. And again, it depends upon the individual doctor. Some of them might wait till 65.
Mark, I have one more question, or one more statement. How come in 1986, if these things are so safe, they have a compensation board that they set up in 1986 for people to collect damages from the shot?
Because that's a law thing. That's a thing that judges set up and politicians set up and such. Once again, ultimately, can you screw up the polio vaccine? Yes, if you work really hard, you can. But how many people has it saved? A lot of people. How many did it kill? Well, in the United States, pretty much no one that I know of, but I'm sure in some country somewhere they screw things up. So if the glass is not only half empty, but probably poisoned, then I don't know what to tell you once again. You're free to believe any kind of scheme that you want, that doctors are in it to control your brains or whatever. I don't know. We're just guys trying to get along and help people as best we can. Do no harm. I swore on Apollo himself.
You know, they say that nobody ever got cancer that never had a vaccine.
As I mentioned a few weeks ago, and I really like this phrase, correlation is not causation. Pretty much, if you think about it, almost everyone that you know died within 24 hours of lying on a bed. So, do you think we should now get rid of beds because it's the cause of death?
Oh, but should they get rid of pools because that kills more people than guns? Or cars? Is this more accidents than people die from accidents?
Okay, Mark, we're veering completely off of science into something completely different. It's a good versus principle. Something has a value, something has a risk. Almost nothing has no risk at all. So I guess most people have decided that they're willing to live with the possible risk of drowning in a swimming pool to having a swimming pool. The same that cars are very important for jobs and all kinds of economic situations. So, unfortunately, we have to deal with the car debt. Guns are slightly different because the value of a gun collection is a little bit less able to measure, but so be it. People want their guns, they have their guns, they fire their guns. A lot of times they fire their guns at themselves, unfortunately. So, again, free country, I'm not fighting against the Second Amendment here. I'm just trying to explain why people probably should do something on the basis of good health reasons.
Roy, each year when they do a survey as to which strains of the flu are major, and they design that into the vaccine for the next year, what stops them from taking every single kind of flu they can find and using them all simultaneously? There's got to be a reason they don't do that. Over to you, Roy.
Yes, because you end up diluting the sample. So the more different strains you add, the less total amount of any one strain that you're injecting. Or if you keep quantity for each of them the same, the more the risk of you'll have side effects from all of these foreign proteins going into you. You know, a simple intramuscular injection of a cubic centimeter is one thing, but you know, if you wanted to cover every possibility for the influenza virus, unless you diluted it all to worthlessness, you would probably have to chug a lug a couple of quarts of that stuff.
Can I sense from what you just said that the typical injection has a volume of 1 cc? I didn't know it's that high.
Yeah.
I would say this, that anybody could go online and go to Novartis or whoever makes the shot, and because the store will not give you the insert, 99%, and go look at everything that's in that shot, and look at all the good, the bad, and the ugly about the shot, tells you all about it. There are two people I've seen film. One is by Lindsay Williams. He used to be the pastor on the Alaskan pipeline, and he made a documentary about vaccines. Vaccines, are they worth it? Talks about Miss Heatherstone, who was the Miss America, who was a normal child who came deaf from the shot, right after the shot, and asking her, was it worth it? Then there's another woman who was a doctor. She's an American Indian. Her name is Tenpenny. And you can look her up also. They give these lectures. I mean, everybody should get both sides of the story. And you could also look up what's inside the shot, or the adjuncts, the Marisol, whatever else they put in there. You get Gatorade, get crippled. There's all kinds of things that can happen. Look, you know me, I'm a little bit negative on this and a bunch of things, but you could, you know, look it up yourself.
Trust me, Mark, I've looked these things up. I've even gone back to the fluoridation scares of the 50s. It was a real fun read, reading a book on it. Don't know what to tell you. I don't really get my medical advice from theologists. If you have a problem with God, you shouldn't really talk to me, being a doctor. I don't really have any expertise in that. So theologians probably should deal more with God and less with vaccinations. But that's my own personal opinion. You can find an opinion about almost anything on the Internet. There's an entire group of people vociferously saying that we're living on a flat Earth. So, you know, again, God bless America. You're free to think any kind of nonsense.
I wouldn't go to God for the shot. The needle is really big.
No, I would imagine he has a very steady hand.
Just imagine traveling, the Earth traveling through space at 94 million miles an hour, and nobody's in charge. That's a wonderful thought.
Gives you comfort, Mark. I'm not here to get you to agree with my view of the universe. You can go on thinking about your view. But I think we've had enough time down this particular rabbit hole, and I really want to make some time for Paul, because Paul wants to, there's something in the news about the Soyuz problem and such. So once again, I think we should move on to the SpaceNet report, and I want to thank everyone for participating. And again, if you need to contact me, it's mailbag@ac2gs.com. And the few stories that I got to tell, there'll be links for it on roy.ac2gs.com. And there's more stories next week, so stay tuned.
Thank you, Roy. Good stuff. We're looking forward to hearing you next week. WS2N, Paul, tell us what that story is like. And I think I heard that they had to sustain something like 8 Gs.